Before we get started, folks, it's important to know that this episode contains some strong and explicit language that may not be suitable for all the listeners. So if you've got your kiddos in the crowd, this might not be the episode for them. We thought about censoring it, but we decided we couldn't, not in good faith, because this episode is fundamentally about free speech and language. We hope you enjoy. And one additional note, we had a little bit of technical difficulty at the beginning of this episode, this first part of our two-part series. Due to this technical difficulty, Noel's mic is actually not on for the duration of the first episode, or for most of it. However, we believe that this interview was important enough and enjoyable enough and fantastic enough that we wanted to salvage it and play it out in full.
And hopefully I didn't say too much.
Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. We have something very special for you today. Now, we get our yucks and we get our guffaws and our chuckles occasionally, wouldn't you say, Noel?
The yucks and the chucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's how we refer to them. But we have rarely talked about the profound depth of story in the evolution of comedy. And comedy is commentary, right, Noel? Like way, way back in the day in Western Europe, even the jester was the only person sometimes who could speak the truth to the king.
Well, sure. I mean, it's a profession of truth-telling, Ben, which is your name.
Oh, that's right.
And it's evolved over time, and it's become an important source of satire and social commentary, and it's these comedians that are able to say things that are needed to help society, like, move forward and to help change laws and change perspectives. Mm-hmm. And that is no exception for the two incredible comics we're talking about today, but we're not doing it alone, are we, Ben?
Right, that's right. Noel, we are joined, of course, as always, with our super producer. We've got Paul Deccan filling in for Casey Pegram today. Make sure you knock out those sound cues, Paul. But we did not come alone into this fray of comics versus the law. We came with an expert. We would like to introduce you, fellow Ridiculous Historians, to the man, the myth, the legend, Wayne Fetterman.
Thank you. Thank you for calling me a myth.
What does it mean to be a myth? Does that mean you don't exist?
That means I don't exist.
Well, it's, clearly you ephemeral. Exist. If you've watched television over the last several
ever,
decades.
Yeah.
I mean, you have seen this man in everything from The X-Files. Mm. I saw you in an episode of Baywatch, which was very impressive to me.
Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, you are Dean Weinstock in Curb Your Enthusiasm, and you basically extorted Larry David for a meeting with Julia Louis-Dreyfus so that he would have a wire removed from his backyard. And then the meeting didn't go well, and you refused to have the wire removed. What is your deal?
What was that line? What was that line in that one where you say, you call that a meeting, I call that one of the most horrible
just
moments.
A horrible moment in my life.
Yes, that was amazing. Also,
just before we continue with my credits, because that's going to be the best part of the show, you know, none of those lines are written. So it's just you have the bullet points of what's supposed to happen in that scene. And we do it, and then we'll do it a few times, and then Larry will go, more of that, less of that, more of this. That's funny. And so every line you hear me say on that show is something I wrote at the moment.
That's even more impressive.
That's incredible. And I have to ask, just to peek behind the curtain, is it a pedantic number of takes or is it pretty chill? Is it pretty much like, let's do it a couple more times. Let's do it one more time. It seems like Larry would be more laid back like that.
Be a little more like a brief emotional direction or something.
Exactly. Yeah. What's the scoop?
Well, that's a good question. This was early on. That's like the sixth episode of the show. So they were still kind of figuring out their technique at that point. And a guy named Larry Charles was directing it. But it's basically Larry David, like, that's close enough. Let's go on to the next thing. Like, it wasn't like, this moment has to be perfect. Mm. And so, so it wasn't a lot of takes. Although I will say this, and this is going to sound like I'm bragging, but I'm not. It's just that Larry sometimes gets like these giggle fits. And so the next time I did the show where I had to hug him and he breaks my glasses and I'm like, no problem. I'll just send you an invoice.
That's
thing.
Right.
he kept laughing every time because I'm so sincere in my like I'm the nice guy who's a horrible guy is sort of was the angle of that dude, that he just kept laughing to the point where he had to apologize to the crew for pushing the shoot back. So
that's great. I mean,
oh my God. I just want to say, I wish Larry David was my dad. I've said that many times. I don't know why. I didn't have a very good relationship with my dad, so maybe that's I'm being informed by that. But Larry David just strikes me as like the perfect curmudgeon, but he also seems like he'd be pretty cool to work with and pretty easy to get along with, despite his character.
So you want
show.
A dad who's a multimillionaire?
Yeah,
I get
course.
It.
Of course I do. No, and, you know, and just makes great observations.
You
on
know what?
Life.
Noel, I agree. I would love it if he were your dad, because then I could just come over, but it wouldn't have to be a forever thing. I could leave. But let us continue just a little bit, Wayne, with some more of these credentials. Some people may not know that you are a professor at the University of Southern California, correct?
That is correct. I am officially, I mean, I'm a professor, that's the right word, but I'm an adjunct professor. Do you know what that means?
Does that mean not tenured?
Does that mean you don't have an office?
All of those things are correct. Whatever you think it means, it basically means not a real professor is what it means. It means I don't have like a master's or a PhD or something like that.
But
I
now, just, are you teaching the history of stand-up? Is that your specialty?
The history of stand-up and a performance class combined.
That's awesome.
And it's advanced. You have to take another stand-up class even to get to Professor Fetterman.
Yeah. So if we were to enroll, we would have to start at level one.
You got prereqs. You have prereqs. For your,
I have prereqs.
That's amazing. And not only do you teach these classes, you also have a brand new podcast on the Podglomerate Network.
That's
called
correct.
The History of Stand-Up, which, surprise, surprise, is about the history of stand-up.
it's not a misdirect. It's not like, oh, my God, we're just going to be talking about youth culture in Monrovia. That's how good I am at ad-libbing. I can't quite get a word out.
But you never know. And we're going to tap some of your knowledge on the subject today for this episode.
Of course. That's why I'm here.
Before we continue, I do want to say I specifically enjoyed the episode on the rise of stand-up, or what we perceive as modern stand-up, through the vaudeville era. And
thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I learned a lot. I'm going to be insufferable at parties for the next few weeks.
Well, do you want to set the stage a little bit with just like, I think the comics we're talking about today obviously benefited from, and you mentioned at the top of the show, Ben, the idea of stand-up as truth-telling and this notion of the vaudeville, what is it called, the performance of one?
Performance in one.
In one. Will you talk a little bit about that, Wayne? Like just this concept?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's just so you know, I know you hold these comedians up as these truth tellers and on the vanguard of social change. And there is an element of comedy that is that. There's also a whole other sea, a whole ocean of comedy that isn't that. That's just making people laugh. And in a way, that's a wonderful experience.
Agreed.
I feel like comedians sometimes get elevated as these truth tellers. It's like they're really just trying to get people to laugh. Is their main goal? So no, if we go back to vaudeville, it's interesting you picked up on that episode, because we talk about this guy Frank Fay that a lot of people look to as the architect of the modern, what we consider the modern stand-up. It's kind of like a wise guy, a smart guy in a suit who does, no baggy pants, no weird hat, doesn't, a crazy big tie or anything like that, that screams, hey, I'm a comedian, just a sharp talking guy. And from that, this guy's name is Frank Fay. And another time we should do an episode, you guys should do one on Frank Fay, because he's a really interesting guy, because he not only creates this, but is this, he's sort of anti-Semitic, and he supports the Nazis, and he's just a crazy dude. He's a very insufferable man, and it's just like that this guy – I love that, in fact, this is the guy that sort of started the whole thing. It's perfect. It's perfect. So anyway, vaudeville was family entertainment, and the height of vaudeville, like what today would be getting a Netflix special, was to perform at a theater in New York called The Palace, which was right off Broadway in 44th – No, it's a little higher than that, 48th. And so that was like the goal of every comedian. And Frank Fay was the MC at the Palace. They used to not even have MCs. They used to just put up a placard or like a big card and say, this is, Fink's Mules. And then this act would come out and they do it. So he would like in between the acts, he'd like kibitz with the crowd. And eventually that became his act. And by performing in one, usually there was a curtain. And so in one was the very front of the stage. That meant there was you didn't need anything behind you. So a lot of times comedians were needed because they would be setting up an acrobat act or a contortionist act behind the curtain while the stand-up was just doing his shtick. So that was called being in one. And now it means sort of like you are alone out there. It's a literal and figurative statement, if I'm not mistaken.
So that's that makes sense, though, from the behind-the-scenes perspective, that you wouldn't want that dead air, right? You would want the audience to have something to look at.
Yep, exactly. You don't want a big, deep stage behind you when all you really need is it's just your voice. And then microphones sort of changed that a little bit, you know, and that was more the nightclub era. And that's when they added something called alcohol to the equation.
And is that when we kind of move more from vaudeville into like burlesque, where it becomes less of a family affair? Is that when the alcohol?
No. Burlesque ran concurrent to vaudeville, which was like a lower class entertainment that was kind of looked down upon, and mainly men went to burlesque shows. Not a lot of women, and it was sort of like there might be a stripper or a fan dancer or something, you know, like that. And the comedians in burlesque were way more broad, and because you had to, you know, there was just guys there in the, you know, degenerates in the middle of the afternoon, you know, watching women. And then it was very hard to do very subtle kind of, you know, Jack Benny type humor to these guys.
Yeah.
So burlesque ran concurrent to vaudeville, but was like considered a low form of entertainment.
And when we were originally talking before doing this episode, we had asked you to share with our listeners some stories about what we would call notorious cases of comedians versus the law. And I'm setting this up now because I believe you had said earlier in the history of stand-up that the term stand-up comic didn't really come about until the late 40s, maybe 1947 or so.
100% correct. Somebody is listening to my podcast. This is a miracle. I love it. I literally thought my podcast was being for like, I don't know, 180 people who are interested in the history of this. So, they didn't have a term for like when Milton Berle was doing stand-up. And we have a clip of Berle at the Winter Garden Theater doing basically stand-up jokes. You know, he does a joke about a restaurant that's so expensive. They have three waiters for each table, one to give you the check and two to revive you. So, you know, just like a joke, jokes. And he was doing that stuff before there was even the term stand-up. So they called him either monologists or comics or something like that. But then eventually, like, bookers wanted to know what you were getting. Like, they would book a variety show and they would need a singer and, maybe a juggler and then a comic. And they'd go, what kind of comic? Does he stand-up? Does he need music? Does he, you know? And so it was a specific kind of comic who just used their voice.
I guess one of the big questions we have, like to Noel's exploration there of burlesque running concurrently with vaudeville, but being considered a lower form of entertainment, where did these stand-up comics fit in? Were they controversial? Were they just something new and strange? Was it a slow evolution or a sudden one?
That's a good question. I think people always, you know, I just think it's a human need to want to laugh, like especially in a group of people. It's a very exciting, cathartic, you know, elevated moment, especially when you're all laughing at the same time. I don't know if you've ever seen a movie called Sullivan's Travels, but it's just a great movie about this Broadway producer who like gets burnt out on Hollywood and goes to see pretends he's like a bum. And one of the great moments is him just watching these cartoons with a bunch of itinerant workers, and they're all laughing together. And it's like, oh, there's value in this. There's value. It's a beautiful movie. And I know that's a little sidetracked, but
not
my
at all.
Point
no, I
is.
I haven't seen it. It sounds fantastic.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. Anyway, Joel McRae. Veronica Lake. I'm going to name the whole cast. People no one's ever heard of. I'm going to keep going. So it's, I don't know. I guess, you know, there's always been funny. But like you said earlier, there's court gestures. And, you know, even, early on in vaudeville, there was like funny comedian singer types, which is like an Eddie Cantor or something like that. And then they were just like, oh, people just like the comedy part. And so people specialized in that. And then that became very much more kind of like an opening act for like a singer. Like I was just listening to like George Carlin would open for this singer named Oliver in the 60s. And Woody Allen opened for Barbra Streisand and then later for Jim Croce. So it was like a great way to sort of settle the crowd, get some laughs, and then, you know, get the headliner up there, unless it was a... And eventually the comics became the headliners.
Well, and it's also like kind of a self-sufficient act, right? Like you don't really need a whole lot of props or, you know, backline or like equipment or anything. It's just a person and their brain and their mouth.
And maybe a microphone.
And maybe a microphone. So that makes perfect 100%
sense. That's why musicians like want to be comics. They're like, oh, I don't have to deal with this road crew guy and this dude setting up my guitar and not tuning it right. And like even to be in a band is a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. Like we just get on an airplane or get in a car and go to the gig and then go back. It is. I think it's the simplest, right? There's not really. I mean, I'm going to throw that out to you guys. Can you think of anything where you need to bring less physical attributes to the act?
No,
not
no.
really.
Maybe podcasting. I mean, they usually provide the mics for us too. We're actually doing our first tour next week, so we'll report back and let you know how that goes.
But we do have headphones.
Oh, you're going out on the road. I love it.
We're hitting the road, Wayne. Wish us luck.
But listen, let's get to the topic.
The headline.
So the headline. Right.
Sorry. I'm full of knowledge. I'm sorry.
Hey, Professor Fetterman, come on. Let's take it easy. So we're talking about the term stand-up not really coming around until the 40s, but around the 50s, you got a guy named Lenny Bruce who comes onto the scene, and he gets his start, you know, doing the same thing that a lot of comedians would do, where he would be on, what was it, the Steve Allen show, I believe he was on, pretty early in his career.
Lenny Bruce is a fascinating story, because he's like this legend, in a way, because of what he did, basically in a, like a 4 or 5 year period. And I'll explain it to you.
Sure.
He was in the war in the 40s. His mom was in show business. She was kind of a comic. He does a talent show and he gets, you know, does a bunch of impressions. And then he's on Broadway open house in 1950. And then he's not really on television at all for most of the 50s. He's basically, remember we were talking about burlesque and strip clubs? He was basically a comedian that worked in strip clubs. Ooh. Was his thing. And which was this brutal existence, but he was, you know, he fell in love with this stripper named Honey, and he, you know, he just could kind of develop this act trying to entertain these guys and was just kicking around, couldn't get anything going, tried to make these short films and wrote scripts in Hollywood and nothing, couldn't get any traction really. And then finally, when Mort Saul came along and opened up stand-up to being a little more about commentary, which you guys mentioned earlier, this inspired Lenny Bruce. And also there was a muse is the word I would use, named Joe Ancis. This is famous comedy history, who kind of developed Lenny Bruce's jazz talking jive style. I don't know if you've heard his records, but it's sometimes hard to even to connect with them because the language is like, you know, so obtuse at times.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Palladium Theatre proudly presents America's fastest rising young comedian and dean of satire, Mr. Frank Dell.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and certainly nice to be here at the most famous theatre in the world, the wonderful Palladium Theatre. Well, folks, I just got back from Las Wages, Nevada. Funny thing about working Las Wages, folks, the way to make a lot of money there, when you get off the plane, walk right into the propeller. And then into the motel jokes, the army jokes, the impressions, 10, 12, 15 minutes, and he's bombing nothing, but not left one. Now he goes into the dying jokes. Oh, well, folks, I wasn't born here, but I'm sure dying here. Ha! A lot of different ways to die. And blah, blah, blah. Now he starts with putting the audience down. Well, Freddie boy, I see it's little Squaresville. Little Squaresville for the first show. The greatest in them all. Oh, not the baby, man. That crap. Let's go to show business heaven. How about it, maestro, eh?
Walks off, gets a little courtesy applause. Two people, sounds like Citizen Kane. Terrible.
And again, this is later in his career. This is not in the 51 or 50. He only started recording later, and that recording is a perfect example of it. Of just this, you know, he would do bits, but he had kind of a hey man style, and he was very much, you know, into amphetamines and pot, and he had a relationship with drugs. Let's put it that way. Ultimately, killed him. And then he puts out this album and. That came out in 1959, and he was known for using dirty words and became what known as a sick comedian. There was a great article in Time magazine about these sick comedians who would do just like one of his jokes would be like, the problem with my marriage was my mother-in-law, because I slept with her too many times, or something like, you know, just like weird, like people would be like, what did I hear? You know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so guess what? He starts making fun. One of his big bits is called Religion Incorporated, and he starts doing this bit. And, you know, a lot of cops are Irish, you know, at that time. and the DAs and stuff. So he gets arrested in San Francisco, and then he becomes known as this comedian who's being censored. And sort of that elevated him a little bit, and then he gets arrested in Chicago at the Gate of Horn. And, you know, believe it or not, George Carlin is at that show. Also gets arrested just because he won't show the cops his ID.
Mm-hmm.
And Lenny Bruce is like, why did they arrest you? Because I wouldn't show my ID because you're a schmuck. You know, that kind of thing. But the big case happened in New York at the Cafe Wawa, I think it's
so,
called.
Yeah, because he's like fed up with these puritanical L.A. cops or Southern right. California cops, which is
right. So he thinks New York is going to be way more progressive,
and that's in Greenwich Village, right?
Yes, yes. This is the scene. You know, Ginsberg's there, and Dylan is there, and it's like it's very couldn't be more progressive.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of maybe Madison, Wisconsin, or something. I mean, it is the centerpiece of progressive. And so he's like, okay, this is where I'm going to do it. And of course, you know, the Irish New York cops, they arrest him. And that arrest and conviction stayed on his record for his entire life. And it wasn't until, I believe, 2003 when Governor Pataki of New York overturned or gave him clemency or whatever, he pardoned him and struck that from the thing. So it was like I know it sounds impossible to believe. That adult, no adult complaint. No, there wasn't one patron. I love using that word, patron. At these clubs, it was like, I can't, like, they knew the sick humor of Lenny Bruce. This is what we want to see. This is what we want to hear. And expand our minds a little bit. We might be offended. We can handle it. So it was just try to think of that, you guys, of a time not that long ago. I mean, I was born in 59, so it's in my lifetime when police would come into an establishment and arrest somebody for using language.
That's insane. They were also undercover police. Is that correct? Like they were there in plain clothes or something.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, the one in Chicago is hilarious and because there's a recording of it. And he's talking about the cop. He sees them over there and then he says something. And then the cop literally says, okay, folks, show's over. You know, like the cliche. And he gets arrested and they just shut it down.
Well, and here's the thing too. They actually, this was on the books. So in New York, when he got arrested, it was because of something called Penal Code 1140-A. And this is the language of this. It prohibited something they referred to as, quote, obscene, indecent, immoral, and impure dram, I assume that means drama, play, exhibition, and entertainment, which would tend to the corruption of the morals of youth and others. This is so broad. This is such incredibly broad language. The corruption of youth and others. And it's like, who's asking for this?
But it's also part of the hypocrisy of the American legal system. That's an historic thing. It goes to any form of language or communication.
Yeah, or even like the Mapplethorpe photographs and things like that.
Or like the James Joyce Ulysses, which went to the courts on the basis of being, what, pornography?
Yeah.
And the ultimate ruling was, I know it when I see it.
Right, right. So this is a very slippery. Now, again, I want to talk about all of these issues, including motion pictures, what's going on with them as well. But the point you're making is youth and others. Was that the language? Was it the youth and others?
Yeah, exactly. The corruption of the morals of youth and others. So what does this even mean? Who's asking for this? Where is this coming from? What are your thoughts?
I will tell you where it's coming from. There used to be something called community standards. And that was basically saying, in this community, we don't want a certain kind of film here, and we don't want a certain kind of entertainment here. And there was, it was a lot of it was, believe it or not, the Catholic League would have their own board, which would decide, would rate movies.
Oh,
and
wow.
Like if the Catholic board didn't let your movie come into your town, it didn't come into your town. And the, you know, and that's how the politicians stayed in power, and that's how these penal codes, including the one you just read, 11, what was the number?
1140-A.
Yeah, I always think of 1140-B, but I always get that wrong. I always get that wrong.
No, that's fair. It's fair.
That's why I'm not teaching at Yale. That's why I'm not at an Ivy League school right there. So that was going on in the United States. Even when I was a kid, there was something called the Catholic League that would like, no, you can't have this movie come in here. So that only changed really in 1968 when they started the movie rating system. So before then, I don't know, this is incredible. It's a sidebar, but I think it's interesting. It's a few years, maybe 8 years after Lenny Bruce gets arrested a lot, is that, you know, they put in these rating systems. So now the first movie to ever be to win Best Picture is a G-rated movie. The only one, a G-rated movie called Oliver. The next year, 69, an X-rated movie wins Best Picture.
What was it?
That's, John Voight, everybody's talking.
Midnight Cowboy.
Oh, yeah.
Which is funny because
it's now been re-rated. It's now been re-rated
Dustin
as R.
Hoffman. Dustin Hoffman is in that, and Dustin Hoffman plays Lenny Bruce in the movie Lenny. So full circle.
Oh, it's all one big thing. But I'm just saying that sort of opened up the world for a lot of moviegoers, especially in small towns in America, because now they could see a movie that the Catholic League didn't deem, immoral for this community. These community standards.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just want to give an overall view of why these penal codes were on the books.
Mm-hmm.
It just gave them a legal reason to shut down a movie or something like that.
Oh, and it's crazy. We take all that for granted these days. I mean, it's so easy to not appreciate the fact that I can go watch anything I want on Netflix or, in the theater, that I can see dirty stuff.
Well, people still do slide back into moral panics on a cyclical basis.
Oh, absolutely.
Let me hear. What do you mean by that?
Oh, so for example, we will see the same kind of moral panic of rock music polluting the hearts and minds of young children because the beat is a little too bouncy.
That's right. I mean, there was even all that Tipper Gore stuff with the parental advisory stickers and music and Marilyn Manson and all that stuff. So absolutely, it seems like that stuff goes in cycles. But ultimately, I feel like as a culture, we're pretty free still to explore whatever, tickles our fancy as far as art's concerned.
I would advance this. We are making progress, especially as a country, we're making progress. But what a lot of people don't know is that this was a hard won road, and that it was uphill for a lot of the ways.
And that's why we're still talking about Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
perfect.
That's really more than any comedy bit he did, any of those bits, which were wonderful. But I think that's the reason. He's number three on the Rolling Stones' greatest comedians of all time or something like that. Is that the reason?
Well, and there's that R.E.M. lyric in The End of the World as We Know It, Lenny Bruce is not afraid. And I think that's a very important way of looking at him. He kind of boldly went and boldly did not give a fuck about what was going to happen to him as far as the law was concerned. And that's why I think maybe overstated the case at the top of the show about comedians as truth tellers. And maybe it's not something they're intending to do at the time. Maybe he's just speaking his truth, and that's because he thinks it's funny. But removed from the time, and with his tragic end and all of this court case and all these court cases, you can't help but think that he was kind of paving the way for this kind of free speech and being able to just say whatever's on your mind and not be persecuted for it.
I think that's what I think you encapsulated it very well there, Wayne, because also he's saying things that everybody knows but no one is saying in public. That's
right, the hypocrisy of it all. Like we've never heard these words.
And speaking of words,
hey, yes. Seven in particular, right? holy smokes, no, this is just kind of off to the side for us. But at this point in the interview, things are really heating up. This is going well.
It's a hot mics.
Hot mics.
Only not a hot mic on this particular installment because due to a technical difficulty, my mic was not properly on. So you're hearing my voice through Ben's mic or an adjacent mic. But we assure you, for part two of this series, my mic will be on.
And we thought this interview was fantastic enough that we wanted to preserve it for posterity. So thank you for checking this out. This is a rare two-parter for us. Have we ever done a concurrent two-parter?
No.
This is a first for us then. We're very excited and we hope that you tune in for the second part of this series, wherein we explore the story of another controversial comedian whose case eventually went all the way to the Supreme Court.
I can't wait. In the meantime, we'd like to thank our super producer, Paul Deccant, guest super producer, Paul Deccant, our super producer in spirit, Casey Pegram. He's always with us. We'd like to thank Alex Williams, who composed our theme.
We'd like to thank Eves Jeffcoat and Christopher Hasiotis, our crack team of research associates. We, of course, would like to thank Wayne Fetterman, but you'll hear us do that plenty in the second episode. And Noel, you know what, man? Thank you.
Yeah, man. Thank you, dude.